you men so foolish? You breeders who breed our men, let the fools, the weaklings, and crazy keep breeding and breeding again.
You're listening to a poem written in 1920 by the superintendent of Virginia Western Hospital as part of his annual report for that year.
The worst is as good as the best.
Joseph Spencer DeJarnett wrote the poem to persuade the state of Virginia to adopt an agricultural practice that he thought could be applied to better the human race. In short, DeJarnett and other proponents of the eugenics movement believe that only the best characteristics of humanity should be kept, and that the worst characteristics of the species should be eliminated by preventing certain people from having children.
Bred true to Mendel's law.
Gregor Mendel, of course, was talking about the cultivation of peas, a plant whose DNA sequence is much simpler than the human genome. Mendel was an Austrian monk who tracked the germination of pea plants in his garden, and his notes on how to grow the best plants became the basis for modern hereditary theory. The science shows that certain traits are passed down from generation to generation.
This is the law of Mendel, and often he makes it plain, defectives will breed defectives. And the insane breed insane.
The eugenic movement began in the late 19th century when Francis Galton, a cousin of Charles Darwin, published works that tried to show how genetics could be utilized to make for a better human race. One of his followers, British mathematician Carl Pearson, created new statistical methods to help track hereditary traits. But J. David Smith, Dean of Education and Human Services at Longwood College in Farmville, says that the theories put forth by the proponents of eugenics were not always scientifically viable. Pearson is reported to have ignored information that contradicted the theories he was trying to establish.
And these were powerful ideas, and as we look back today, it's easy to see that what was created out of them, in fact, was a pseudoscience. Eugenics compared to what we're seeing develop today in terms of genetic science is in some cases laughable.
Nonetheless, the eugenics movement took hold in the United States. Indiana passed a law in 1907 that allowed for forced sterilizations of people under that state's care.
It is chilling to see that those very rudimentary ideas, and in many cases very incorrect ideas of the hereditary nature of certain qualities, were dead serious and led to the development of social policies that affected the lives of millions of people.
Smith's book, Minds Made Feeble, outlines how flawed the studies used by the eugenicists were. Proponents of eugenic laws based much of their information on now discredited family studies that tried to show that poverty was an inherited trait. If the science was wrong, why were so many people affected? The story of what happened in Virginia illustrates what happens when bad science meets public policy. Paul Lombardo is professor in law and medicine at the Center for Biomedical Ethics at the University of Virginia. He explains the law was copied from language written by a prominent eugenicist.
Virginia's law was modeled on a law written by Harry Laughlin, a law that was actually publicized in 1914 called the Model Eugenical Sterilization Act.
The logic went, if people with disabilities were not allowed to have children, future generations would save money that would not be spent to take care of their children.
Virginia took up this cause in 1924 for a number of reasons. The man who wanted a sterilization law more than anyone else in Virginia was Dr. Albert Priddy.
Dr. Priddy was the superintendent of the Virginia colony for the epileptic and the feeble-minded. The colony later became known as the Lynchburg Colony, and today the same campus is called the Central Virginia Training Center.
Priddy began sterilizing people around 1915 or 1916, even though there was no law that allowed him to do this. He claimed that it was his prerogative as a physician to operate on any of his patients in any way that he thought was appropriate for their health.
But eventually, Priddy's assumptions were challenged in court. A Richmond family filed suit against him for operating on the mother and two daughters without their consent.
He didn't lose that case, but he was warned by the judge that he ought to wait for the legislature before he did any more operations.
In 1924, a bill based on Harry Laughlin's model sterilization law passed the General Assembly and was signed into law by then-Governor Lee Trinkle, who had been elected on promises to reduce state spending on social welfare.
The very first thing he did upon becoming governor was make a trip to every state institution and ask the superintendents what could be done to save money. The sterilization bill was a direct response by the doctors who ran the state hospitals to Governor Trinkle's charge.
Priddy's lawyer cautioned him that the law would have to be tested throughout the U.S. federal court system. A test case would need to be found to prove the law was indeed constitutional. Their eyes turned to Carrie Buck, a Charlottesville woman who was pregnant when the forced sterilization law passed.
She had been raped by a relative of her foster parents in Charlottesville. Her foster parents went to the local authorities to have her sent away. She was picked for that role because her own mother was already at Lynchburg.
Carrie's mother allegedly had several illegitimate children and was believed to be unmarried, though Lombardo says it was later shown that Carrie's mother was actually married.
So they had two generations seemingly showing that this problem of having illegitimate children and perhaps being a prostitute was something, according to eugenical theory, that was inherited.
The trial was stacked in favor of the eugenicists. A man with little experience in litigation served as Carrie Buck's attorney. The judge ruled that Priddy could sterilize Carrie. The case hinged on Carrie's infant daughter, Vivian, whose IQ tests showed that she appeared to be feeble-minded. These tests were conducted by an employee of the Eugenics Record Office in Cold Harbor Springs, New York, which was set up to promote eugenics. The case was appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, which upheld the lower court ruling with emphatic zeal from one of the court's most remembered veterans.
Oliver Wendell Holmes was proud to be on the cutting edge of scientific thinking and endorsing eugenics, and he said so in his own private letters and correspondence, as well as giving what has been called the most totalitarian statement in the history of the United States Supreme Court in declaring of Carrie, her mother, and her daughter, three generations of imbeciles are enough.
Holmes delivered a genetic death sentence to the Buck family, cutting off their family line forever. Vivian died at the age of 8, and Carrie Buck died in 1983. The Virginia General Assembly also passed a racial purity law in 1924 to prevent the intermarriage between the races. Longwood's Dave Smith says the state was looking for other ways to control potential threats.
Eugenics being very much entwined with the idea that we've got to control people of races other than the Caucasian race.
As many as 8,000 people would be sterilized in the state of Virginia between 1924 and 1972. Nationwide, 60,000 were given vasectomies or tubal ligations against their will, in the name of science and in the name of good breeding.
Well, why do we allow these people to breed back to the monkey's nest?
Again, the words of Joseph Spencer DeJarnett, who pushed for the 1924 sterilization bill that started it all.
Oh, you wise men, take up the burden and make this your loudest creed. Sterilize the misfits promptly, all not fit to breed.
They wanted to prevent the procreation of the feeble-minded, the insane, the criminalistic, the epileptic, the inebriated, the drug-addicted, the diseased, the blind, the deaf, deformed, orphans, ne'er-do-wells, tramps, the homeless, and paupers.
Democrat Mitch Van Yeres represents the Charlottesville area in the Virginia House of Delegates. He introduced a bill last year to express the state's profound regret over the eugenics law that was passed in 1924 to authorize forced sterilizations.
You can see where the state had made a major step in the wrong direction.
The law required that each patient receive a hearing to determine whether or not they should be sterilized. Paul Lombardo, a professor of law and ethics at the University of Virginia, says the hearings rarely occurred in a meaningful way.
The guardian who was supposed to look out for the rights of those patients was paid $5 per person, and oftentimes sterilization hearings took place for 10 or 15 or 20 people at the same time.
Phil Thyssen, an activist who works on mental health issues, believes many Virginians think those who were sterilized were profoundly mentally retarded, but that isn't the case.
Many of these people that were put in state facilities were strictly poor, uneducated, and the state didn't have many of the facilities that it does today in programs in place, like juvenile homes.
When I went to June 6, 1940, and I sterilized October the 31st, 1940.
Jesse Meadows was only 17 when his father sent him away to the Virginia colony for the epileptic and the feeble-minded in Lynchburg. In 1940, it was standard procedure for the state to take away his ability to procreate.
So many said it would help me. I wouldn't have no feeble-minded children.
He hadn't committed a crime, and he didn't see himself as a burden to society.
Why did you go to the colony in the first place?
Didn't have no home, and my mother died when I was real young. And my daddy, my stepmother said my daddy didn't get rid of my mother, children, that she wasn't going to leave him. He started having put one place in another, and he found a way to get rid of me.
He wound up in the colony because he had been framed for arson, so he was sent from his Madison County home to the colony at Lynchburg. He would spend most of the next 12 years there.
My mother, before she died, she called all of her children to the bedside and told him to be good, meet her in heaven, and called my daddy to the bedside and told him to take care of her children, see if they brought up right, and she wasn't dead 6 months before he was married again. My daddy would sometimes he'd call the colony. He won't be out long enough to come home to clean up some land.
He was paroled from the colony in 1942 and went to work for the Aberdeen Proving Grounds in Maryland. When the Army found out that he had been institutionalized, he was fired. With no other place to go, he voluntarily signed up for another stay at the colony. He thought he could come and go as he pleased, but he was essentially jailed for another 10 years. But it was the cheap labor he provided that made him such an attractive person to keep at the colony.
I'd want to go home and tell me I couldn't go because they made me out of paint. I painted some of the buildings by myself. I'd go to work for people. I'd be trolled out to the supervisor's sister and her husband. I'd trolled out to the woman's supervisor for 2 or 3 weeks, painted her house inside and out. And I'd paint the trolley all day sometimes for 25 cents a week. And some at night, some of the employees would want me to go to their house and paint some for them.
When he was finally released from the colony in 1952, he had a hard time getting employers to pay his Social Security. Others tried to use the fact that he was a former patient to intimidate him.
People look down on you like you're an animal when you've been to a place like that. Sometimes you'd walk up and down the street and people would see you and say, yeah, the way you old colony patient. One time I was sitting in a restaurant, me and another, my wife, we were sitting in a restaurant drinking beer. Some old man coming out working the colony said, I'm going to turn y'all in for being here drinking beer. He crawled back over there and they told him, said, he's discharged. You can't bother him now.
When he was let go from the colony in 1952, the superintendent at the time told Meadows he should never have been a patient.
And Dr. Hurl said he checked up on my people and said he found out my daddy ought to have been over there instead of me. Said I touched the wrong start in life.
Meadows got married in 1960 and his wife died in 1989. They were never able to have children.
She blamed my daddy. He signed the papers, too, said he'd do anything to get rid of me.
Do you still keep in touch with people who you were with at the colony?
One woman lived down the street, Sarah Jane Wally.
They didn't even let us know nothing about this until after I was 22 years old.
Sarah Jane Wily was taken to the colony when she was 12, along with her younger brother and sister. She had grown up in southwestern Virginia. Today she is a 65-year-old woman who recalls what it was like when she was sterilized in 1958.
The guy from Richmond took us into a meeting, a big bunch of us, Lois Stern, my brother, Eddie Marsh, Carla Marsh, Ann Marsh, girl named Gertrude, all of us, we went into a meeting.
It appears that lying to the patients in order to get their cooperation with the sterilization procedure was quite common.
When a girl named Shirley Breeden, she had the same thing done, and a tenant named Miss Woods was working with us, and the only way she got Shirley to go to the hospital was to tell her she was going to have a appendix out. We thought sure it was our penis, but we wouldn't. We was operating on to keep us from having children. Had a tubes. A little girl named Donna Suana, she ran away. Got killed by a train. That's the reason she ran away. She didn't want to be operated on.
Wiley worked as a nursing aide before she graduated from the colony, which became known as the Central Virginia Training Center in the 1970s. She had been institutionalized for most of her life. She not only had to get used to living in the world, she also found out that she couldn't have children.
Didn't even apologize to us, no.
Do you yourself regret not being able to have children?
Yes, because I loved them. I used to look girl next door. Every time I get any money, I give her stuff. Yeah, I love kids.
Wiley would like to be paid damages for her experiences, but she doesn't expect that to happen anytime soon. Currently, she struggles month to month to make ends meet. After her husband died, she wasn't eligible to keep receiving his disability check. The General Assembly's expression of profound regret seems to be enough for Wiley, though, but Jesse Meadows isn't satisfied.
I think I ought to apologize to the regret. I'm a bit late for that now. I think I ought to pay people for the way they've done them. I know that'll never happen.
Mary Bishop, a reporter for the Roanoke Times, has spent much of the past 10 years researching the life stories of the victims of eugenical laws.
This is what happens when certain people are devalued, systematically devalued. This is what can happen very quietly, behind the scenes, and no one's aware of it. The general public wasn't paying attention and didn't realize that their government was rounding up people, putting them into institutions, declaring them inferior, and sterilizing them against their wills. God made me to have children, so what man has the right to change me?
Bishop reads from a letter written by a woman named Louise, who was sent to the Lynchburg colony for the epileptic and the feeble-minded in the 1940s. The woman was sterilized at the age of 12.
I look around the world and see on TV some people have babies and not be married. Some kill them before they are born. I just don't see what right they had to do it. A lawyer once told me that was a price I had to pay because I was poor.
Eugenics was a worldwide movement with its theoretical origins in Britain and its first practical applications in the United States. Many other countries in the world followed America's lead in writing eugenical laws in an attempt to better society. The most extreme case occurred in Nazi Germany. When Adolf Hitler took power in 1933, he copied the same model sterilization law that was used in Virginia. University of Virginia law professor Paul Lombardo says that unlike other countries, the United States has not seriously addressed its eugenics past.
Germany paid reparations to people who could prove that they were sterilized. Sweden, I believe, paid reparations. Switzerland is considering it. It's being looked at also in Japan. In Canada, there were a series of lawsuits. One of the provinces which had a sterilization law, which was actually, again, modeled on the American laws. And Alberta survivors were paid over $140 million Canadian dollars. Nowhere in America has a nickel ever been paid to a survivor of the eugenics movement.
Lombardo says that the United States has also ignored the moral lesson of eugenics because Oliver Wendell Holmes' ruling in the Kerry Buck Supreme Court case still stands. Three imbeciles are enough still remains as the last legal word on the issue of eugenics in the United States. In 1979, the American Civil Liberties Union attempted to sue for damages on behalf of Virginia sterilization victims. The state settled out of court and offered counseling to those who could prove they were sterilized. But the offer wasn't well publicized, and the state made no effort to track down some of the approximately 8,000 Virginians who were prevented from having children.
Lots more people than that were sterilized. Many people were sterilized in private hospitals and private institutions. Many people were coercively sterilized in the 60s and the 70s as a condition of receiving welfare benefits.
More than 20,000 people were sterilized in California. In all, 30 states had sterilization laws on the books. In the 2001 session of the Virginia General Assembly, a resolution was passed to express profound regret of the eugenics movement in Virginia. This marks the first time that any legislature in the nation has acknowledged the government's role in the eugenics movement. Phil Thyssen is president of the Lynchburg Depressive Disorders Association, a support group that meets to discuss concerns involving mental health.
We've brought this whole issue of the sexual sterilization up in various conversations with a number of state officials over the years. It was kind of always a bit of a taboo subject that you don't go there, we don't talk about this. The state really didn't want to address the issue.
Thyssen's group spent much of 2000 looking for a patron to sponsor a resolution asking for an apology on behalf of eugenics victims. Letters were sent out to all 140 state legislators. Delegate Mitch Van Yeres of Charlottesville became interested in eugenics in the spring of 2000.
Delegate Van Yeres stepped forward right at the very end before the General Assembly started and agreed to be the sponsor. There appeared to be widespread support, but no one actually wanted to be the patron.
In order for the resolution to pass, the language was changed to express profound regret rather than an apology. Van Yeres says there is still work to be done in order for Virginia to atone for its history. Virginians must know this history, he says, especially at this point in humanity's technological evolution.
We're now tampering with genetics, gene splicing, and I want to make sure that we know our lessons of history well before we get too far advanced into playing and tampering with the human genetics again.
Van Yeres suggests we may be traveling on familiar roads, and we could use the maps that history can provide.
The whole question of cloning, the whole question of gene manipulation, DNA privacy, all of these things are coming up now as serious questions for the future. And I think we have to deal with them on this level and understand what we have done in the past in order to deal with this in the future.
Phil Thyssen expects more states will follow Virginia's lead and pass similar resolutions in the near future. But the federal government needs to remember its role as well.
I think the United States government needs to step back and look at the issue nationwide and memorialize the eugenics victims. I don't believe personally that compensation is appropriate.
Thyssen insists that Virginia law would stop any new move for compensation dead in its tracks. That's because the state has sovereign immunity. Instead, Thyssen says, the state should concentrate on collecting the stories of victims.
There needs to be documentation. In terms of the impact on the lives of those persons affected directly that were sterilized in the eugenics movement, and what we would like to see is their life stories permanently documented.
J. David Smith is Dean of Education and Human Services at Longwood College in Farmville. He's written several academic texts on the eugenics movement, but says many students know nothing about the subject.
I am amazed at the number of college students today who are shocked. They had never been made aware of the eugenics movement as part of their social studies curriculum.
The Roanoke Times' Mary Bishop is currently on leave in order to do research into the life stories of eugenics victims. In 1985, she met a Rockbridge County woman who had been sterilized.
And once I got to know her and wrote about her, I realized that there were lots of other people, probably thousands, who had been through the same thing and who needed to be interviewed before too long because they were all getting old.
Since then, Bishop has been tracking down victims in order to collect their stories for publication. So far, Bishop has discovered and interviewed 26 of the survivors. She hopes to also broaden her search to find some of the 1,100 African Americans who were sterilized at a colony in Petersburg.
A lot has been written about the political history, the legislative history, even the scientific history of this movement, but very little has been written about the people who had this done to them.
No master lists were ever kept of who was sterilized, and so she and other reporters have been digging through courthouse records to discover who went through the procedure.
They were essentially told, "You and your kind are not wanted in the human race. We will not kill you. We will let you subsist, but we don't want any more like you on the face of the earth."
Bishop says the expression of profound regret has been a good first step, but she believes patients who are sterilized in state institutions deserve financial compensation.
People were not just sterilized. They were often put into an institution as a child and taken out of school. They were deprived of a normal education. They were deprived of the chance to do work and find a trade early on. Many of them were kept in the hospitals for years and years. And were so wounded by this that they never really recovered.
And if that's not likely, she says, a more heartfelt apology is required.
So that they feel that they have at least gotten some satisfaction in knowing that this state recognizes what it did to them. So they can go on and end their lives with a little bit more dignity than they've been afforded to date.
The 1924 law that authorized the use of forced sterilizations to prevent the so-called inferior from reproducing ushered in the age of eugenics. UVA law professor Paul Lombardo explains that the era didn't last for long.
The majority of the sterilizations were done between around 1930 and 1945.
By the late 1950s, most sterilizations were performed on people who had been diagnosed with developmental disabilities or mental retardation. The argument was that these people could not take care of their own children.
The language of the original eugenics legislation was taken mostly out of the law by 1974. The last language that specified you could sterilize people for so-called hereditary reasons didn't leave the statute until 79.
And as new technologies are developed to improve the human race, new questions will arise as well. Last year, the entire sequence of the human genome was mapped out, though it could take decades for geneticists to fully understand the complexities of the code that makes us who we are. Lombardo says scientific solutions to societal problems can be valid as long as caution is exercised. The question is, do the means justify the ends?
The hardest question to be answered in using the new reproductive technologies, in using such things as in vitro fertilization or prenatal genetic diagnosis, is how much do these look like the methods of the past? In what ways do these intrude on the rights of individuals?
Delegate Mitch Van Yeres of Charlottesville thinks it could be dangerous to have the power to genetically modify basic human characteristics at will. That's one reason he introduced the profound regret resolution which passed in the last session of the General Assembly.
We have to differentiate between doing good manipulating genes and knowing the DNA, which we can say we can control some hereditary diseases, but we don't want to try to control what the human being would be like.
Phil Fison is president of the Lynchburg Depressive Disorders Association. The group would like to see a permanent collection created at an educational institution devoted to the study of the victims' lives. Such records are important, Thyssen says, for they will help guide us into the future.
We really need to look in terms of how science is being applied today and how that may be looked at 50 and 100 years down the road. especially when it comes to full human cloning. And we know when they've done it in animals that you've had some horrendous mistakes. And what's going to happen when you have a tragic outcome involving a human being who's been cloned?
Doris Zallin is professor of science and technology studies at Virginia Tech. A geneticist by training who now works in the emerging field of bioethics, Zallin says the completion of the Human Genome Project has raised as many questions as it has answered about our genetic makeup.
These new insights that we'll get into our own genes are far beyond what those early eugenicists ever dreamed of. I mean, the early eugenicists looked at people and said, well, they had some kind of problem, and therefore it was genetic, and therefore one could solve this problem by preventing people from reproducing. Now, we can peek directly into the genetic material and look at the genes themselves.
Zallin says the improved science can be used to predict who might be susceptible to certain diseases. The refined knowledge of genetics offers many potential benefits, but Zallin cautions it may just as easily bring on a new form of eugenics.
This raises the question of, could we once again be drawn into a position in which we start judging people by their genes, this time by their DNA sequences? And might we begin to discriminate against people or marginalize people because their genes are different or because their potential health problems are expensive?
In gene therapy, a malfunctioning gene is replaced by one that works in order to correct a genetic illness. However, scientists are not yet ready to manipulate genes in the way that Van Yeri suggests. Zallin explains that promising technology still needs to be worked out.
It's turned out to be harder to get the genes into the right places. It's turned out to be harder to get the genes to function properly.
Zallin says there is the potential for parents to augment their children's life if these techniques are perfected.
Being taller or thinner or smarter or more athletic, these are the kinds of qualities that we think parents might be interested in promoting in their children. And in a few years, we may have the genetic tools to do that.
The choice whether or not to develop such techniques is fraught with ethical questions. But lessons offered by the memory of the eugenics movement offers the chance to inform that choice.
It's really our responsibility as a society to make sure that we don't repeat those same mistakes, that we don't judge people by their genes. In fact, we all have a few genes that are less than perfect, and it's wrong to prevent people from having opportunities for education or jobs or insurance because of their genetic makeup.
For now, Zallin says scientists need to do more research into how genes work before they develop some of these techniques. She cites the early reliance of the eugenicists on Mendel's law as an example of the importance of getting the science right.
We truly don't understand the multidimensionality of genes, all the different things that they could do. Originally, we thought humans have about 100,000 different genes. Thanks to the Human Genome Project, it looks like we have about 30,000 to 40,000 different genes, not much more than a fruit fly. Our genes have capacities that go beyond what we originally thought genes could do. And it would be extremely foolish to mark or label people because of their genes when we don't understand all the various dimensions of gene function.
J. David Smith, Dean of Education and Human Services at Longwood College, insists that the humanities must be taught alongside the sciences at universities to instill a sense of ethics in tomorrow's inventors.
The people who were involved in the eugenics movement believed that ethics were inherent in the science and medicine of eugenics. They could see that everything should be done to produce the strongest population of people. The ethics and the principles that will help us make the right decisions don't lie in science. They don't lie in medicine. And I think only with a better informed citizenry can we carry on the conversations and make the kinds of decisions that are going to be necessary to humanize the science that is developing at such a rapid pace.
Virginia's eugenics history will be the subject of an exhibit that will open in 2004 at the U.S. Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C. Paul Lombardo is helping to set up the exhibit by providing historical materials. Mary Bishop hopes to publish the life stories of survivors. The state of North Carolina is looking into reconciling its involvement with eugenics. And perhaps the best legacy we can give to the surviving victims of the eugenics movement is to look at where we are going and decide, in their memory, that we should proceed with extreme caution. For Virginia Public Radio, I'm Sean Tubbs.